Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenney. On today's program, Yellow Springs residents Ruby Wells Nicholson and her daughter Jane Scott hit the StoryCorps booth for a conversation you don't want to miss. Emily McCord will have this week's Politics Ohio, and we'll hear a bit of music to round out the program. Chris Castle and the Womack Family Band stopped by Excursions Friday for a live in-studio performance. Stay tuned for that. But up first, joining us in studio, Krista McGall with Tecumseh Land Trust. Krista is the executive director, and today we're going to talk about the Market Maker Project, a database to link food producers and food buyers. But first, we're going to learn a little bit about Tecumseh Land Trust. Krista, welcome to the studios.
Great to be here.
The Tecumseh Land Trust is basically a land preservation
organization. Yeah, we work with landowners who are interested in preserving their properties to conserve basic natural resources that are just plain irreplaceable. People who have prime soils on their land, which are useful for food production and necessary, we realize more and more, for food security. And people who have water resources on their property also. We've got such an abundance of water in Ohio, which is not true in most of the world. So what we do is, if landowners are interested in pursuing options to preserve their land, we kind of lay out ways that they can place a permanent conservation easement on their property. They still own their land, but they can choose to get a tax deduction from the value that they're giving up by limiting future development on their land. Or sometimes we're able to pay them. And the way that we are able to generate those dollars is writing a lot of grant applications to the federal government, state government. We've got some local governments that are really concerned about keeping ag as an industry in the area and preserving natural resources. And some of them actually come up with some match money, which is an extremely helpful thing. We've preserved a little over 19,000 acres of farmland, a few hundred acres of all natural areas that have got some real unique animals and plants on them, some wonderful forests. We kind of mowed it all down at one point in Ohio, but they're coming back. And we have a really wonderful time meeting these landowners, you know, hearing the history of their properties and the stories of their families on these lands, you know, sometimes for hundreds of years.
You mentioned funding, so we'll talk about that in a minute. But what are some of the other challenges with regard to land preservation?
Well, one thing is that we are a membership organization. And so we really have certainly got some landowners who are members of our organization. But we need to have members of the public as supporters of the land trust. And if we don't, we're not available to actually provide that education to landowners, field the phone calls. Typically, it takes quite a while for somebody to make that kind of serious decision. So we do a lot of public talks. We go to, you know, Rotary clubs, different kinds of community groups. We work a lot with local government, of course, to provide them assistance and kind of complement their plans. But what makes us able to do that is membership. So we try to offer educational programs to our members every year. And this year, our educational programs are about exploring local food because that is what our membership is most interested in. And our membership is as varied as the population around here. We've got old folks and young folks and moms real concerned about their kids having access to safe, healthy food. People are really into getting to know their local farmer, you know, these days. So we're doing this whole series of field trips and educational talks, and it's really a lot of fun. And it also has the added benefit of hopefully making our farmers' operations more profitable in the long run. Generally, people that are farming corn and soybeans get maybe 9 cents on the dollar. of the value that they produce, whereas people who sell directly get more like 60 cents on the dollar. So in the long run, it also perhaps makes our preservation work a little bit more viable to be able to open some doors for people, be able to make a little bit better living. And when those dollars are spent locally, then they bounce around in the local economy. People estimate between 4 and 7 times. And so that's good for everybody.
There's certainly tremendous value in that local connection and being less dependent on some of the larger food systems and government sources. But that brings me back to funding, and people are having to pare back. Organizations are seeing less funding coming in. How is that affecting the land trust?
Well, we are very much in touch with our state and federal representatives to try to make sure that they rightfully keep some priority on these funding sources. We're really talking about irreplaceable resources. You know, we absolutely have to safeguard our water for sure. And I think American Farmland Trust has an expression, asphalt is last crop. You know, it's very, very hard to reclaim land once it's developed. So a lot of what we work with is Clean Ohio, which was passed by the voters. In fact, it was renewed with 70% of the vote statewide in 2008. And every county in the state passed it. This is amazing public support. So we're right now looking at the next rounding of funding getting approved. It's a bond issue. So the legislature now actually has to sell the bonds or approve sale of the bonds. And so we're at a point where they have to pull that trigger in order to get the next round of funding in place. And we're having all kinds of conversations. And it's something that's very important to let legislators know that we feel strongly about. The Clean Ohio actually has three parts. There's a trails part, an agricultural part, and an open space part that really lends itself to protecting the land along creeks and rivers, wildlife corridors in particular. And so those three parts together, it's very strong. You know, almost everybody has a connection to one of those types of natural experiences. So that's a real important one right now. At the federal level, we work a lot with the Farm and Ranch Land Protection Program, which is out of the conservation title of the Farm Bill. And it's a very popular program. We have had great success with it, and we're able to match it often with local funds or with funds to protect water resources. And that's sort of our favorite thing, because we'd much rather buffer a river with well-farmed farmland than to have a housing development right up against it with lots of roofs and driveways. And the water is certainly going to flow off of those roofs and driveways much more quickly into the river. And you've got a whole lot of neighbors, which also makes it a little bit harder to make sure that everybody's being the best steward in the world.
Now, your focus is in Greene and Clark County, and that focus is on mainly rural and farmland. But I'm interested in what you had to say about returning developed land and how challenging that is as far as preservation. How involved in that is Tecumseh Land Trust?
Well, it's kind of interesting because it isn't our mission per se to do that, but we have partners who it is absolutely their fundamental cause to redevelop. And a great example of that is the Center City Association in Springfield. We collaborated with them and a number of other businesses to really push for getting the hospital downtown when they merged their two hospitals. That's several years ago now, although the hospital's almost built. It takes a while for these kind of things to come about. But we realized, you know, early on around the 2000-2001 period that we were doing the perfect complements to each other, that they were revitalizing the downtown, and we were keeping the rural. The county officials in Clark County have been very supportive because they really see that they need to stop the sprawl and keep their infrastructure costs low. There is quite a bit of sprawl around Springfield. Over the years, mistakes have been made, but at this point, they really are trying to do everything as cost effectively as they can, and so it's a real win-win situation. One of the features that's attractive to people in downtown Springfield is the farmers market. And that is a very historic farmer's market. I think it began in 1874 at not exactly the same location, but across the street from where it is today. And it's really one of those things that people come together around. It brings people downtown on a Saturday. And so both Center City and the Land Trust try to kind of help out in whatever way we can to build that organization. And as we do this Exploring Local Foods series this year, Center City is one of our partners, as is the Master Gardeners in the county. You know, what we're looking at is where might there be possibilities for redeveloping the buildings that are not used right now downtown as food processing facilities. That would be a really good fit. We have a lot of farmland preserved around here. You know, we have sort of lost our food processing capacity over the years. Most food travels at least as far as Chicago. Meat, grains, what have you. A lot of that food's traveling pretty far away before it gets packaged or processed and then distributed. So again, if we can sort of pull in that local economy a little bit, it really benefits everybody.
So that brings us to how do you make that happen, connecting people to local resources? And I want to talk about the Market Maker database to link food producers and food buyers. How did that project come about? And what stage are you at now?
Okay, the Market Maker program is something that was developed by the Extension Office in Illinois. And they have been gradually going live with it nationwide. Ohio went live, I would say, probably 8 or 9 months ago, something like that. It's an interactive database that a grower can put their information into about what they grow, what seasons of the year, what times of the year they're going to have those products available, how far they'll go to deliver them. And even, you know, what they might be interested in beginning to do in the future. And then buyers of food, distributors or restaurants, can do the same thing. They can enter what they're interested in, when they need it, how much they need. And this is all just online, virtually instantaneous. It's really easy. I am 55 years old, and I entered information for one of the farmers markets locally and was able to successfully get the information input. Farmers markets who are looking for particular kinds of growers, like we don't have enough flowers that are being sold in our market, so we'd like to attract some flower vendors. That's the kind of thing that people can put into that database. There's also then the value-added processors, so people who maybe want to look for more berries so that they can produce Ohio-raised raspberry jam, something like that, can put their information in too. And, you know, there's no magical promise that everybody who puts their information in is going to double their business within the next 6 months, but they're pretty likely if we can populate that database to at least make a few connections. And over time, obviously, it just builds. The more information that you have in there, the more likely some matches are going to be made.
Okay, and you mentioned delivery, and I just want to clarify, this is not like a home delivery service. You're talking about, right, farmers markets or local stores that want to maybe enhance the local produce that they have to offer.
Right, right. And those distributors can be the middlemen on that. And that's really kind of where we need to go, you know, in order to really surface local food in the major food chains, you know, the grocery chains, you're really going to have those distributors involved. It doesn't make sense for every farmer to be driving over to Kroger's, you know, with their load of produce. But there's, you know, small connections. Definitely that happens a lot with restaurants. There's a lot of local growers, you know, on a daily basis, actually, bringing them their fresh fresh greens, bringing them whatever's in season at that point in time. And it's so there's sort of every scale also of interaction that's possible. And so we're just a connector in this situation. The payoff in for us is that our members are learning a lot. We're getting some new members who are interested in finding out about some of these things, particularly the field trips actually to some of the farms that are doing something a little bit new or different. That's the kind of thing that whole families can enjoy too. And we really find, especially with young families who are very concerned about having healthy food for their family, they need some field trip opportunities to get out on a Saturday or Sunday afternoon and help teach their kids where food comes from.
Well, let's talk about the Market Maker event that you have coming up at Antioch University Midwest.
Yeah, that's coming up Monday, the 28th. This is tomorrow. It's going to be from 1 to 3 in the afternoon. The OSU Extension staff person who is actually in charge of getting information out about that Market Maker program statewide is going to come and do a presentation about what all it's capable of. And I'm really looking forward to that because so far I've only played on it myself and read a couple information pieces that they've put out about it. But she is so excited, you know, to come to our area. She's located in Piketon, but has the capacity to go any place in the state, and was just, you know, very excited to be asked to come talk to folks in our area. Now, this is the classroom of the future at Antioch Midwest where this event is going to be held, which means they have 30 computers online in the room. And so anybody who comes and wants to put their information into that database should be able to walk out of there with their information online, and maybe they'll make a connection or two, you know, in the next few months. It's probably not the best thing for just a consumer who's just generally interested, but for anybody who is a grower or wants to be a grower or is a restaurant operator that's looking for more fresh food, farmers markets that are looking for more vendors, more variety in what they're doing, and definitely distributors.
Now, anyone hearing this today, is there a chance that they can still get into this seminar?
There are still a few spots left, yes. So we'd love for them to give us a call, and if we do get completely filled up, we can let them know, you know, it is a good problem to have if we have more people interested, because we can then just set up another follow-up and get those people in the next session. Our phone number is 937-767-9490. And we'd just love to hear from you if you'd like to come, and we definitely do still have a few spots.
Krista McGall with Tecumseh Land Trust. Krista, thanks so much for speaking with us
today. Oh, it's been a lot of fun. Thank you, Jerry.
You're listening to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for joining us this Sunday morning. Up next, Miami Valley StoryCorps. Ruby Wells Nicholson has lived a long and full life. Born in Kentucky in 1910, Ruby survived the great flu epidemic and saw the birth of the automobile. Today, Ruby and her daughter Jane Scott live in Yellow Springs. In the StoryCorps booth, Ruby shared memories of rural life, the changing of the seasons, and preparations for spring.
For you, what was exciting about the summers? What do you remember? Anything, major events of farmers coming in or threshers?
Oh, yeah. The wheat threshers, that was a great event. Farmers, when they started the machine up and the straw was coming out the long pipe, the farmers would then form that straw that was blown out into a circle and then built it up to a stack. And the women brought in food in a basket to feed the work hands. It was quite an exciting time.
What'd the women do with the straw?
Oh, the women took clean straw ticks. Now, a straw tick is a piece of cloth sewed together to hold a big bag to hold the straw. and they filled that up with straw, and that was used instead of a mattress. We had no mattresses, so we used straw. And as winter went along and the straw became pretty thin, and the women would go in the middle of that tick and stir it up, and then to keep the straw on top of the straw matting, they would use feather beds. And then on the feather beds, we would raise the geese to produce the feathers, and my mother would put that old goose, turn it upside down, and put it between her legs, and she'd pluck those feathers off the stomach for our pillows and the feather beds, and the old goose would peck her legs to make them blue.
Must not have been a very pleasant thing for the goose, no. I bet.
Your mother either.
Or your mother either. You called her your mother, and I called her Granny Baugh because her name was Bertha.
Bertha Elliott Wells.
Bertha Elliott Wells.
Bertha Jane Elliott Wells, because you were named for her. Your name is Jane Elliott.
That's right, and I'm proud of it. Now, what did they do about chickens? I thought chickens were a big part of the economy for the women of that era.
Yeah. Now, chickens, they have certain periods to lay their eggs, and hadn't had this technology and all these lights to make chickens lay a lot like they do now. And so, in the springtime, when the chickens began to produce quite a few eggs, my grandmother would say, "Well, I'll get that at the store if my hens lays good." Hens lays good. Now, get that. That's her English. And they'd take the eggs to the store and get 3 eggs worth of sugar or 3 eggs worth of crackers or something.
So they were money.
Yeah, that was money.
Ruby Nicholson and her daughter Jane Scott at StoryCorps in Dayton, Ohio. Their conversation will be archived in the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress and on the WYSO website at wyso.org.
Welcome to Politics Ohio. I'm Emily McCord. Today I'm joined by Sonari Glinton. He is a reporter for NPR News. Welcome.
Thank you.
You've been in Ohio this week covering the ongoing debate over collective bargaining. And I'm curious, how does Ohio compare to what's happening in Wisconsin and in other parts of the country?
Well, the difference between Ohio and Wisconsin runs deeper than Buckeyes and Badgers. It's in Wisconsin, the teachers union is really the one that's sort of like on the block, whereas police and firefighters have been cut out. In Ohio, police and firemen are a part of this group that is having their collective bargaining rights curtailed some. So in Ohio, the Senate Bill number 5 would take away all the rights to collective bargain for state employees and then limit them only to salary for local workers. So that includes firemen, police, etc. And that's a huge difference because politically, it's sort of hard sometimes for Republicans to vote against bills that would be seen to be anti-police or anti-fire. And in Ohio, that's going to be a political problem for some Republicans.
I want to ask you, since you are a business reporter for NPR, Ohio Republicans say changes to collective bargaining will help the budget deficit and promote job growth. And Democrats say, well, no, it doesn't. What impact would changes to Ohio's collective bargaining have on business in the state?
Well, I talked to Kevin Bacon, who is a senator from Senate District number 3, and he's the chair of the committee that is, you know, having hearings on Senate Bill number 5. And he would say that what it does is it allows state and local governments to have flexibility so that if they wanted to increase or decrease wages, they could, instead of being locked into labor contracts. And so that it's not necessarily that it would be a line item on the budget, but it would allow the state and the municipalities to go and make changes as the economy got better or it contracted.
Are there other states in the country that have been either positively or negatively impacted through collective bargaining when it comes to attracting business?
Well, that is sort of the contentious issue. You know, there are right-to-work states, and then there are states that are unionized. So for instance, Ohio, Wisconsin, Michigan are not right-to-work states. There is, you know, the jury's sort of out on whether or not there is a benefit to being a right-to-work state or being a state where, you know, public employees are parts of unions. You know, you have arguments on either side, but the studies, and study after study sort of shows that there's not that much productivity. Like, there's productivity doesn't sort of change when groups are unionized or not. So it doesn't really have an effect. That's what at least, you know, recent studies have shown.
One of the other big arguments here is whether or not public sector workers get paid more than the private sector counterparts. Is there a definitive answer to that question?
There's not a definitive answer, but a lot of times you'll hear politicians say, well, that public sector workers make more than private sector workers. But you have to think first that often private sector workers have, on average, lower education. The real way to look is to look job to job. That's where you would look to find out if, you know, a teacher in the public school makes the same as a teacher in a private school, or a doctor at a public hospital makes the same as a doctor at a private hospital. When you do those comparisons, public employees end up making less often. But, you know, critics would say, how often does a, you know, a private sector lawyer work 70-hour weeks, and how often does a public sector worker work 70-hour weeks? And also, a lot of times people talk about wages and they don't include pensions. So, it gets a little tricky, but those are some things to think about when you hear people talking about the difference between private sector workers and public sector workers.
Now, President Obama was in Cleveland this week, and he was talking about jobs, but he did not address collective bargaining. What's the significance of that?
The president sort of got his hand slapped last week when he mentioned Wisconsin. You know, there's some thought in Washington, at least, that the president is going to let this sort of play out because that it's a changing of the way the administration looks at strategy, that it's going to pick a topic, it's going to pick a thing, a theme, and follow that theme for a week instead of sort of, you know, going from issue to issue in a week. So if the president is focused on jobs, he's only going to talk about jobs all week and not sort of react to these cyclical things that keep popping up. But it's also, you have to realize the political calculation is that the president doesn't want to be seen as meddling or playing politics. But there is no doubt that the White House and people in the White House are looking very closely at what's going on, because in a way it sets up 2012 to allow this drama to sort of go on, allows for people, the emotions to get stirred up, especially among union workers who then go to vote and pull the lever for Democrats.
I've been speaking with Sonari Glinton from NPR News. Thanks so much for being here.
Happy to do it.
This is WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks for joining us. This Friday, Nikki Dakota had some in-studio guests for a bit of conversation and some music. Chris Castle and the Womack Family Band were playing in the Dayton area on Friday night, and we're very pleased that they stopped by the studio. Here's a bit of the music we heard.
All right. Sometimes when I write tunes, they come to me in pairs, and that first one that we opened the show with, Clean as Bleach, and this next song came to me. They were the twin sons that were born the same couple of days. So it's funny that this one would be called Dirty Water. But so it is. I hadn't planned for this. Thought I'd washed my hands of it. Dirty water all down my drain. Dirty water never cleaned nothing. Raised by poor men, broken from paying for pointless war and original sin. Dirty water all through my veins. Dirty water never changed a thing, child.
Lead me down. wipe my eyes.
Music from Chris Castle and the Womack Family Band. You can learn more about that band at dirtsandwich.com. That's it for this week's edition of Why So Weekend. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks for joining us on member-supported 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield. If you missed any part of today's program, you can listen online at wyso.org. Our Why So Weekend theme music was provided by Magnolia Bolthead. Coming up next on WYSO, The Book Nook.
Talking like a madman stuck on a bad, bad dream. Dirty water all in my brain. Yeah, dirty water, and it's running like a freight train.